Quiet down. Just like to thank Dr. Gorin for coming and lecturing us. Hope you enjoy.
Where's the pointer? Oh, you got it. Thank you. I got it later. Yeah.
You can point with everything with the actual pointer. You can use the.
Oh, one. Oh, okay. All right. Perfect. I love you. Thank you. All right. Okay. All right. Welcome, everyone. I don't think it's going to take an hour. It'll probably take an hour and a half. No, I'm kidding. Maybe 45 minutes. Maybe less, but we'll see. Short and sweet, all right? To the point. All right, so today we're going to be talking about, I'm giving you an intro to perioperative medicine, okay? So this is something that's very significant for the third years, somewhat significant for the second years, and you know, a little bit significant for the first years, because you really don't do a lot of this pre-op evaluation until you're in your third year doing med consult as an inpatient. But as an outpatient, there is a med consult clinic, which you all will be attending at some point during your tenure here. So it does apply. Okay, so here we go. All right, so basically, back in the 70s, there was a Dr. Goldman, who he's sort of the grandfather of a lot of this cardiac risk assessment and all these indices. He came up with the Goldman Cardiac Risk Index, and this is for, obviously, patients undergoing non-cardiac surgery. So at that time, he identified a number of risk factors which he thought that would make the patient at increased risk for having cardiovascular or cardiopulmonary complications perioperatively and or postoperatively. So he came up with this number of things that are sort of intuitive that would make you think that the patient might be at higher risk of having some sort of complication, and assigned a point system to all of those things. And then you would add up the number of points. And at that point, you would say, all right, is the patient in the low-risk category, high-risk category, moderate-risk category, et cetera. So basically, it was age greater than 70, an MI within the last 6 months, JVD or an S3 Gallop, obviously signs of acute heart failure, significant aortic stenosis because they likely have issues with fluid management and fluid overload, irregular rhythms, frequent PVCs, frequent APCs, and so on and so forth. You can read the rest. So, you know, hypoxia, renal failure, and emergent operation. So these were the things that he thought were significant, okay? And then you would assign a point system to it, and then based on the point systems that, you know, your patient has, it would tell you the risk of complication and or the risk of death, okay? So the more points you have, obviously, the more likely you're going to have a complication and or death. So if you look at, like, class 4, for instance, if you have greater than 26 points, in order to get 26 points, you need to have had a very recent MI within the last 6 months and heart failure, you know, with JVD now. So that will give you, you know, 21 points and then maybe be in AFib or something like that. Okay, so that would give you, you know, and intuitively, that's the patient, obviously, who's going to have some issues, right? So, you know, it all makes sense. As time went on, they revised all of these cardiac indexes, and this was written in 1977, so most of the older cardiologists and cardiovascular physicians use Goldman, and they all refer to Goldman's index. And obviously, if you're going to be a cardiologist, you need to know this inside and out because it's part of the history of cardiac perioperative medicine. But this index, for me, it's something that's difficult to remember, you know, because it's all these criteria, and you know, how do I, you know, you're looking at it, and you got, it's hard to memorize. So, a lot of people, a number of physicians have tried to modify it and simplify it thereafter. And then as time has gone on, as we've gotten into the 80s and the 90s and now the 2000s, things have been simplified and some of these things have been narrowed. Some of these things have been removed from the list. But honestly, the majority of what he has here is still the basis of the cardiac risk assessment, and you'll see as we go forward. So in 1986, Dr. Detsky came up with his modified cardiac risk index, which is similar to this, and he just gives a separate set of point system and includes the type of surgery, which Goldman didn't really do in his first cardiac risk index publication. So there are all these calculators. Like, if you go on the internet and type in Goldman risk calculator or Detsky risk calculator, you can calculate exactly, you know, type in the number of things, and then it adds up the points, and it tells you what risk the patient is in. But we don't generally use this, okay? I'm not saying you shouldn't. We just don't. Okay, so the severity of perioperative stress. So what makes a surgery moderate risk, high risk, or low risk? And when I was a resident, I was a second year or third year resident, you know, I had no idea of this concept. You know, it's just probably me. But I thought at that time, I was like, okay, well, there are certain procedures that fall into moderate risk and certain procedures that fall into high risk, and I'll just memorize them because I really had no idea what was the reason behind why, you know, something was high risk versus low risk. I mean, some of it is obviously intuitive if you're getting a cataract surgery or a breast adenoma removal. That's not the same type of surgery as someone who's getting, you know, a lung resection or a fempop bypass, obviously, okay? But it's mainly because of the amount of hormone that's expressed, stress hormone that is expressed during the surgery or at the time of the surgery. So in the high risk category, you have anytime you touch the aorta, it's going to be high risk. Okay, so cross clamp for some reason in particular, intrathoracic surgeries, you crack the chest, or you do any vascular surgery, all of those are pretty much high risk. Okay, your orthopedic surgeries, your guillotine amputations, head and neck surgeries, and CEAs, even though it's technically vascular, it's not the vascular they're talking about. The infrainguinal vascular they're talking about is the fempops and the pop-pops and the bipops or whatever those are that they do, and the AAAs, the open AAAs, things like that. Those are the procedures they're talking about. The CEA is technically falls in the moderate risk category. And then the low risk category, you have TURPs and anything superficial, removal of, lipomas, you know, all these superficial procedures, those all fall into the low-risk category. Okay. All right, so the perioperative stress hormone, you have norepinephrine, epinephrine, which is expressed at the time of surgery, at the time of the cut, essentially. So most anesthetics actually suppress many elements of the stress hormone response. So therefore, we're not going to expect the patient to have a massive MI right at the time of surgery. It usually happens postoperatively. Okay, so once you remove the anesthetic agents or reverse the anesthetic agents, that's when you start to get into the problems. Okay, and the different complications you have are obviously tachyarrhythmias. We see patients who always go into post-op AFib. Okay, or just sinus tach, SVTs. You'll get called when you're third year and you go down to the PACU. I'm sure some of you have experienced this. Patients in SVT. So, you know, you have to obviously respond to that. Hypertension, myocardial ischemia, hypercoagulability. You know, once you cut a patient, it's a hypercoagulable state because the coagulation cascade kicks in and they become hypercoagulable at that first cut. Patients become hyperglycemic, develop CHF, and have all types of electrolyte abnormalities, especially with fluid shifts. Okay? Wrong way. All right, so there's non-invasive preoperative cardiac testing. Okay, so what are the things that we have in our little armamentarium? All right, we have, here at Jacoby, we've got the first four. Okay? Over at Montefiore, they do have dobutamine stress echo. Here, we don't have it for a number of reasons, which I'm not going to go into. But we do have exercise thallium and dipyridamole thallium, dobutamine thallium. You know, those are the stressors, and the thallium is the actual stress test marker. So these are all the things that you could conceivably use if is the question, you want to do some preoperative cardiac testing. But the literature actually supports that the best test to get if you're going to do a stress test, any stress test on a patient, would be a dobutamine stress echo. Okay, and this was noted through a meta-analysis by Shaw. So they found that this had the highest positive predictive value of possible ischemia. It's very well tolerated by the patient. You know, what are you doing? You're putting a probe on the patient's chest, and at the same time, or before and then after, you give dobutamine, okay? And dobutamine is your stressor. So that is sort of a marker of the surgery. It's supposed to be a surgical equivalent. What would happen to this patient if he was undergoing surgery? That's why you're giving the dobutamine, to stress the heart. So you stress the heart, and now you look with the probe at the echo. And at that point, you'll see, all of a sudden, they have apical hypokinesis or apical akinesis, or, you know, a number of walls that are akinetic, hypokinetic, etc. So that gives you more of a real-time synopsis or analysis of what happens to the heart when the patient's under stress, okay? So that would be the test you would order if you had the test here at Jacoby. However, you won't be at Jacoby for the rest of your life. So if you go elsewhere, this is the sort of gold standard, okay? And as I say that again, as if you are going to order a stress test. So we're going to go into that a little more as we go on. Okay, then you have pulmonary complications, all right? The pulmonary complications are these, okay? Diaphragmatic dysfunction, hypoxemia, pneumonias, aspiration pneumonias, etc., bronchospasm and respiratory failure. These you're not really going to, this is something you're going to consider, you know, could the patient be at risk for one of these things? It's something that you would consider if the patient's suddenly hypoxic. PE should be on here as well. You know, these are the things you would look into. Preoperatively, there's not much that you can do about these things. I mean, if there's an asthmatic, you let the anesthesiologist know that they're at risk for bronchospasm, you know, especially if you give them beta blockers. Pneumonia, you obviously wouldn't want to send someone into surgery with a pneumonia, but sometimes you don't have much of a choice but to do that. Okay, so the evidence supports that there's no need for pre-op PFTs, okay, in most patients, because it's not really going to change your outcome. Except, I guess, maybe if a patient is having a is having a lung resection and you want to know if they have reserve, then you might get PFTs. But for the patient who you just want to determine if they have COPD or if they have asthma, there has been no evidence that it changes the outcome. You just respond accordingly. If they start wheezing, you give them, you know, bronchodilators, etc. And there's also no data to support routine pre-op chest x-ray. We do it all the time. You know, patient comes in, they're over 40 years old, they get a chest x-ray and EKG. And that, I think that comes from sort of old management. But it does not support that it's going to improve patient's outcome. Now, listening to the chest to see if they have heart failure, yes, that's going to help, okay? But, you know, just getting a pre-op chest x-ray just because is not really useful. Okay, so if someone has asthma, what kind of recommendations are you going to give them? You're going to consider starting oral steroids, especially in anyone who's moderate to severe or severe asthmatic. So the moderate persistent, severe persistent, those asthmatics, the ones that, you know, are always in here, they're always wheezing, they're always on prednisone, those are the ones who you may want to consider giving them prednisone, PO, 24 hours before the surgery and on the day of surgery and sometimes, you know, maybe like a five-day course to decrease inflammation. And the studies have shown that there's no increase in wound infection or impaired wound healing or hyperglycemia in the setting of giving those steroids. So it's something that's okay to do. It will help the patient's lungs. Okay, so you would also give inhaled albuterol or Atrovent for wheezing. And if the patient is going to stop smoking, they really should ideally stop 2 months prior to surgery. Okay. All right, so the other asthma recommendations is, you know, when you're telling the anesthesiologist, when you're giving your recommendations, the anesthesiologist, really, all they really want to know is that the patient is an asthmatic and what type of asthmatic and how many flares do they get and, you know, or what category they fall into. You could tell them that you might want to consider use of regional anesthesia, spinal anesthesia. Let's say it's a very bad COPD or that you're afraid is going to get, if they're intubated, you know, under general anesthesia, that they may not or have difficult extubation. In those patients, you might say you might want to consider spinal anesthesia if it's a, you know, surgery that is amenable to that. And, you know, but once again, the anesthesiologist is going to decide what they want to do, all right? So you're giving those recommendations just to say that this is what we're concerned about. The anesthesiologist is obviously trained in anesthesia, and they're going to do what they think is the best for the patient. You would recommend nebulizers for intra-op flares. There are certain anesthetic agents that are useful in asthmatics because they are bronchodilators and they pre-treat the airway. Okay? All right, so what does the anesthesiologist know? All right, the anesthesiologist knows how to cancel cases when we give recommendations that are essentially not congruent with what they want to hear, okay? And the reason we do all this pre-op testing, really, the surgeons want pre-ops because they know that without the pre-op, the anesthesiologist is going to cancel the case, okay? The surgeons will pretty much operate on anything. You know, but they are very concerned that once anesthesia comes in and they swoop in the night before the surgery, I don't even know the anesthesiologists in this hospital, honestly, because you never see them, ever. I don't know where they hide. I don't know who they are. I've never met one anesthesiologist in the 8 years I've been here, okay? I don't even know if we have anesthesiologists at this institution. No, I'm kidding. But, you know, you just don't know them, so you can't really discuss the case with them. You know, they come in at 8 o'clock at night or 9 o'clock at night to pre-op the patient, and then that's usually the resident, and then the attending anesthesiologist sees the patient, you know, in the morning at 7 o'clock in the morning. So, obviously, there's no interaction between the medical team and the anesthesiologist. All right, but they're very good at canceling cases if they think there's some issue. They're very well versed in IV. All this information came from an anesthesiologist, okay? They're very well versed in IV medication. So if you want to treat hypertension with labetalol, you need to give insulin, you need to give metoprolol pushes, IV Lasix, albuterol, some IV morphine, dilaudid. They're very good at that. Okay, but once you start telling them to give PO medications, they start to get nervous, okay, because they don't really know. You got to remember, anesthesiologists do primarily anesthesia, some SICU, some MICU time. Maybe they do a rotating internship in their first year, maybe, not always. So they don't know how to do certain things with PO medications. So once you start recommending PO medications, they get a little bit nervous, okay? But they can handle emergencies. That's what they're good at. They know about the choice of anesthetic agents. So you would never tell the anesthesiologist, oh, I suggest you use propofol, okay? You're the internist. Stop giving them recommendations about what they know, okay? And also the choice of invasive or non-invasive monitoring. So, you know, you may say, I recommend the patient needs a Swan-Ganz catheter for this surgery, but they're going to decide, they're going to get their cardiac anesthesiologist and decide whether they want to do that or not, okay? But it's something you can make all the recommendations you want, but obviously don't try to tell the anesthesiologist things that they know. So, you know, kind of don't overstep your bounds. So what does the anesthesiologist not know? Okay, they do not know the long-term management of chronic problems. That is your job as the internist, okay? We know we're very good at managing all of these things, hypertension, CAD, renal failure, endocrine diseases, hepatic dysfunction. We know how to manage all of this. They do not know how to manage most of this stuff. So these are where you're going to give the recommendations preoperatively and then postoperatively. This is also has to do with the surgeon and what surgeons know about managing chronic problems. So what does the anesthesiologist want to know from you? Okay, the anesthesiologist generally wants to know, when you're talking about drug regimen, if you say, oh, put the patient on, you know, Norvasc, or put the patient on metoprolol and start at 25 milligrams BID, you know, they don't know how far and how quickly to titrate meds. Okay, so if you go from 25, at what point can you go to 50? If you just started 25 today, can you give 50 tonight? You know, these are things that they don't generally know. So they want to know what would be the first line drug. You know, if the patient doesn't tolerate a beta blocker, can I give a calcium channel blocker? Can I give an ACE inhibitor? So, you know, you give them recommendations based on what we should start. And then let's say you give them a beta blocker and the heart rate's now 55 and their blood pressure's still high. So what would you use next? You know, that's the kind of stuff that they don't know. So that's what you need to help them manage, okay? And then the expected side effects. You know, if we're starting a beta blocker today, monitor for bronchospasm because patient has asthma as a child or patient, you know, had some history of remote asthma. So, you know, or monitor for bradycardia, whatever you think could possibly happen with this drug that would be, would affect or influence the surgery, okay? Then they want to know from you what further tests might be indicated preoperatively. Does the patient need a stress test before they go to the OR? Does the patient need an echo before they go to the OR? What tests do you want to recommend prior? Do they need a chest x-ray for some reason, you know? And these are the recommendations that you will make. And they'll look at your note. They may not do everything that you would like them to do, but they may cancel the case if certain things haven't gotten done and they think they are obviously necessary by what you're recommending as the internist. Okay, and then you're going to give them management suggestions. And I put suggestions in italics because, once again, these are just that, suggestions. You're usually not the primary doctor. You are the, you know, consultant who is suggesting that this is what I would do or this is what you should consider. And, you know, they're going to therefore do what they think is necessary. And then if they have a question, they'll call you. And this is where the dialogue would be nice between anesthesiology and internal medicine, but it just doesn't happen. Okay, then they also want you to help. They want help to optimize the underlying disease state prior to the surgical insult. So if a patient's decompensated CHF, you know, maybe if this is a surgery that can wait a couple of days, an ankle fracture or something like that, you know, maybe we should try to diurese the patient, you know, get them optimized medically before they go for surgery. Because obviously they don't want to get in there and have, you know, a catastrophe on their hands. And the one thing to know is that we never really clear patients for a certain type of anesthesia. Like sometimes we'll say, well, we're going to clear the patient for local anesthesia, but if they need general, they're high risk, you know, or clear the patient for MAC, but, you know, if they need general, you know, we're not going to make a statement on that, you know, so you shouldn't really do that because what happens is sometimes you may start with MAC and then when they get in the OR, something happens and they have to convert to general. So, and then that puts them in a predicament where you clear the patient for the MAC, but not for general anesthesia. And, you know, that could put them in harm's way. All right, they also want to know stent info, all right? If a patient has a stent, they want to know the type. They want to know the location of the stent, when it was placed. And the antiplatelet agents are more for the surgeons to know than the anesthesiologist. But, you know, they'd like that information. If the patient had a drug-eluting stent placed recently, then, you know, there may be some issues with stopping the Plavix. There may be some issues with stopping the aspirin, okay? So that's something that they want to know in the pre-op evaluation. All right, if the patient has an AICD or a pacemaker, all right, they'd like to know when it was placed, when it was checked last. This information you may not be able to get, obviously, urgently, but usually by the next day, the patients always have a card, and you can call, you know, Guidant or whomever and try to determine when it was last checked, when the battery was changed, that kind of thing. Because they're going to decide during the surgery, especially if there's a lot of electrocautery going on, they may need to put the pacer in fixed mode or turn off the AICD. And they do that essentially by putting a magnet over it. And they can just, if the patient needs to be shocked, they can just remove the magnet and it goes back to the normal state. And they also want you to suggest cardiology when needed. They generally don't go start calling cardiology consults, okay? That's something that medicine usually will recommend rather than them doing it themselves. Okay. Any questions so far? No? Okay. All right. So as the internist, your primary goal is to not simply clear the patient for surgery. That's what the second-year surgical resident will call you and say, I need you to clear the patient. And really what they want you to say is the patient's clear for surgery. But mainly because of medical legal reasons, we don't really write the word clear in the chart. Okay, so generally what we do is say, you know, we're going to optimize the patient to reduce their risk. We use words like that, okay? You want to sort of optimize the patient's risk for cardiopulmonary complications based on the patient's current medical status in conjunction with the degree of perioperative stress caused by a particular procedure. Okay, so that's what you're doing. You're doing a perioperative assessment of the patient. You're not clearing, quote-unquote, the patient. And then, secondarily, you want to provide management recommendations which pertain to the patient's underlying problem. Okay, so the ACC-AHA 2007 guidelines on perioperative cardiovascular evaluation and care for the cardiac surgery. All right, this was recently updated in October 2007. All right, this document is 200 and something pages. Okay, it's this big. All right, this is double-sided, all right? This is the new Bible, quote-unquote, for perioperative medicine. It has pretty much everything in it that you would ever want to know, okay? So with these guidelines, these were updated from the 2002 guidelines, the bottom line is And if you don't take anything else away from this lecture, this is the bottom line, okay? Intervention is rarely necessarily to simply lower the patient's risk unless it is indicated irrespective of the planned procedure, okay? So if the plan is the patient's having ST elevation MI right now, yes, you need to intervene prior to them going to any surgery. If the patient has left main disease, studies have shown that a CABG does affect and influence complications and mortality. Other than that, for the most part, intervention is rarely necessary. Okay, and when I say intervention, I'm talking about PCI, you know, stress tests, things like that. Okay, all right. So the components of the perioperative evaluation. This is what you're going to write in your note. All right. You want to give a history, including chronic illnesses. It's an H&P like you would do an H&P, okay? But the P is different. The plan is different. But the history is the same. Chronic illnesses, meds, social history, physical history, physical exam. Prior history of cardiac workup. So has the patient ever had an echo? Has the patient ever had a stress test, a Holter monitor? Have they been cath? That's all information that your attending is going to want to know and that you're going to want to document in your note because that's going to influence your management. And then you want to assess the patient's functional status. So how many metabolic equivalents are they able to achieve on a regular day? Their past surgical history, how many surgeries have they had, what type of surgeries have they had any complications with those surgeries, prolonged intubations, bleeding excessively, PEs, you know, they want to know if there are any complications from the anesthesia, do they have a cardiac arrest, or, you know, they want to know all of that. The anesthesiologist obviously should be getting that history themselves, because that's more their area, but, you know, you can sort of help them out by also obtaining that history from the patient. You know, you include diagnostic imaging, if they have chest x-ray or something else, you know, you put that in there. And EKG is actually only indicated in moderate and high-risk patients, okay? If someone comes to the hospital, they generally get an EKG anyway, but it's really only indicated in moderate to high-risk patients. That was something I learned, because I just tell everyone to bring me an EKG if they go for surgery. I don't care if they're low-risk, moderate, high-risk, I want to see the EKG. But it's clinically not significant in low-risk patients. Okay. So you want to first establish the patient risk, then you want to establish the surgical risk. All right? So patient risk. Okay, so who's high risk? High risk are people that are sort of obviously high risk. And, you know, this is definitely intuitive. If you've had an MI within the last 30 days, you're at pretty high risk of having another MI, okay, during surgery or postoperatively. Or having some unstable situation happen. Unstable angina, severe angina, a positive stress test, you know, recently, an echo with a very large ischemic burden, decompensated CHF, people with JVD, S3 Gallop, you know, active acute heart failure, arrhythmias, obviously high degree heart blocks, second and third degree heart blocks, or symptomatic arrhythmia where they keep syncopizing from it. And severe valvular disease. These are all people that you're going to document what they have, and you're going to call cardiology 9 times out of 10, okay, because you don't really want to manage these type of people on your own. The high-risk category, cardiology generally, not always, but generally needs to be involved because if you're going to send these people to surgery, they're likely going to have some issue. All right, and there are some people who emergently have to go to surgery, you know, and they had an MI, you know, 2 weeks ago, and you have no choice. But these are people you're going to want cardiology to, in conjunction, manage with you. You know, if someone has severe valvular disease, depending on what it is, they may suggest putting a Swan in or something like that. But once again, these are not recommendations that you'll generally make as an internist. This would be cardiology. Okay. All right, so the intermediate risk category patients are patients with mild angina, a remote MI greater than 1 month ago. If you remember from the Goldman Index, he thought that anyone who had an MI within the last 6 months was at high risk. Same thing with the 2002 ACC guidelines. They had it up to 6 months. If you had an MI within the last 6 months, you were at high risk. They've now sort of narrowed that down and said if it's been more than a month, you're likely not at high risk, but you're more likely to be at intermediate risk. All right. People with stable CHF, EF at 30%, but they're not decompensated right now. Those people are moderate risk. Creatinine greater than 2, uncontrolled diabetes. That means, you know, over 200. Hemoglobin A1C over 7, technically. Q waves on EKG. So this is essentially every Jacobi patient, okay? Like, everybody's probably at least intermediate risk. There's very few patients that come through this place that are not at least intermediate risk, if not high risk. Okay, we do have some low-risk patients every once in a while, but, you know, we have a lot of end-stage renal disease patients, a lot of diabetics, a lot of, you know, patients with CRI, CHF, you know the drill. Okay, so in this category, you're also going to want to address the patient's metabolic equivalence, all right? And the metabolic equivalents are here. The working metabolic rate relative to the resting metabolic rate, okay? So the patient's ability to perform a spectrum of common tasks correlate well with the maximum O2 uptake by treadmill testing, all right? So what they found is, let's say, surgery is 4 METs. If you can do at least 4 METs, you're likely going to be okay to withstand a surgical stress, okay, essentially. So the magic number is 4. So 4 METs would be doing lighthouse work, climbing a flight to 2 flights of stairs, walking level ground for, I think, it's 4 to 5 blocks. This you can all look up. It's all on the internet. It's in the ACC guidelines, so you can sort of determine what the patients can do. I always ask the patient, can you walk up a flight of stairs without stopping, with chest pain or shortness of breath? That's generally the screening question. But, you know, if you have a patient who's playing tennis every day, you know, or playing golf or something like that, it's likely that they're not going to have issues in terms of the surgical stress on their body. Okay, if they do these things without chest pain, I mean, if they're playing golf and get chest pain every time they go out, obviously, different story. That's just a stress test, a constant stress test. Okay, so they found that there's an increased cardiac and long-term risk in patients who are unable to meet the 4 MET demand. All right, so in these patients, they're the ones who, you know, may need some intervention prior to surgery. All right, perioperative ischemia is more common in those with poor exercise tolerance. All right. So, you know, patients with a low functional capacity may benefit from preoperative stress testing. Let's say you have a patient who is going for a cholecystectomy, and, you know, you find out that their METs are 2 because they have this crippling arthritis, you know, in their knees bilaterally, so they can't really walk around. So those patients are effectively, even though they never get chest pain, they're effectively not stressing themselves enough to determine whether they would have chest pain because they're just not really moving around much. So in a patient like that, you might want to stress them, might is the operative word, to see if at, you know, their target heart rate, do they now become symptomatic? Do they now have signs of ischemia on EKG, et cetera? Okay, so there's very few people that you'd want to stress, but in some cases, you might want to stress somebody. But if you do that stress test, then what are you going to do thereafter? You know, are you going to cath them now? Are you going to stent them now? You know, are you going to CABG? You do a CABG? I mean, it all depends on what you find on that stress test. The stress test is usually for you to feel better about clearing the patient. You know, if the stress test is negative, you're like, good, all right, let's send the patient. But if it comes back positive, now you're left with a positive stress test and a patient who needs surgery. It's sort of difficult to determine what to do in that state. And that's where all the clinical questions come up with these patients. All right, so the stress test can help identify preoperative ischemia, inducible arrhythmias, and to help estimate the cardiac risk. It can also help to identify at-risk territory after a recent MI. So let's say a patient had an MI a month ago, and you want to do a stress test because you want to see if there's an area of hibernating ischemia or an area of, area at risk. That, you know, if it says that it's just a scar there, then it's likely that they'll be okay to go for the surgery. All right. There is only real evidence to support stress testing in patients who have 3 or more risk factors and who have a poor functional capacity and require high-risk surgery only if it will change management, okay? So most of these studies that they have done have been in vascular patients, high-risk surgery, vascular surgery. So it's kind of difficult to then extrapolate from, you know, a patient who's not, or extrapolate that information from a patient who's not having vascular surgery, who's not a high risk, okay? And that's where all these questions come in. Well, you know, would they benefit from beta blockers if it's a moderate risk surgery? Or if they're an intermediate risk patient, would they benefit from beta blockers or, you know, some other further testing? It's very difficult to, you know, use that data that's been done in vascular patients only, and now apply it to your patient. But this is the data we have, and, you know, in the age of evidence-based medicine.